Welcome back to Libromania, a new podcast for the book obsessed from the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern. If you love books and all the things that make books great, this podcast is for you. Each week, I'm presenting conversations with authors, designers, publishers, artists, biographers, critics, and scholars about the things that make books worth celebrating. We'll be talking book design and bookstores, book printing and book collecting. We'll be talking about the lives and problems of famous authors and the science behind our love of books. We'll be chatting with working writers about their process and with scholars about the art of writing biography. This is chapter two, in which I cheat a little bit and talk about movies, the best movies of 2018, to be precise. Joining me is Mr. Jeffrey Overstreet, one of my very favorite film critics. Jeffrey is the author of Through a Screen Darkly, his film-going memoir, which I highly recommend, as well as novels like Aurelia's Colors and The Ale Boy's Feast. And his award-winning arts writing, including reviews, columns, and essays, have been published in Image, Paste, Christianity Today, Books and Culture, and many other magazines and websites over the last 15 years. Currently, he's a creative writing professor at Seattle Pacific University, and he regularly teaches courses and seminars on film and creative writing. To find Jeffrey's reviews, including his choices for the best movies of previous years, you know, like, you know, 2017 or 2006 or 1999, then you could head over to lookingcloser.org. And again, that's lookingcloser.org. As I say in the show, in the conversation, Jeffrey was a huge inspiration to me back when I was studying film in college. So this is a privilege. This is an honor to chat with him about the best movies of the year. I have long wanted to do this, so I was honored and excited that he said he was up for it. So let's get right to it. Here's my chat with Jeffrey Overstreet about the best movies of 2018. Well, thank you for joining me for this conversation. These end of the year conversations about books, movies, music, all those sorts of things are a lot of fun and certainly some fodder for plenty of debate, I'm sure. But it's a pleasure chatting with you again. I've always wanted to talk to you about end of the year movies. And now instead of doing that, you know, 140 characters at a time, or just by, you know, arguing with you when you're not there. Now I get to argue with you in person. Well, you know, sort of in person. So thanks for joining me.
Well, I enjoy arguing. There was a moment at the end of my senior year of high school, there was a moment at the end of a class where some of us were arguing about a text with the teacher. And one of the young women in the class walked by and said, why can't you just enjoy these things? And I remember my teacher turning to her with this sort of solemn look, and he said, "This is how we enjoy them." And so I hope that in social media, you know, when I'm being a film critic and nitpicking about things, it can sound like snobbery or being a curmudgeon or something, but really, I mean, it's done with joy and love for the form. I mean, this is how I enjoy movies. So I think being able to hear people talk about it, I think helps, because you can hear the tone of voice. So
yeah, that's true. Tone is not something that always comes across very well I was gonna say in the written word, but especially on social media.
exactly.
So this has been quite an interesting year in movies, I think. There have been a number of, you know, really large blockbuster movies that were really well reviewed, whether that's Black Panther or even the new Mission Impossible movie Fallout. There have been a number of documentaries that have been really beloved, such as the Mr. Rogers documentary. And then there have been, you know, despite whatever what many of the critics have been saying, or some of the fears of some of the critics, there have been a number of, well, shall we say, you know, for lack of a better term right now, the indie movie seems to be going strong despite the changing landscape of Hollywood. Yeah. But I pulled up the, just out of curiosity, not because I think it actually can tell us much of anything. I pulled up the Rotten Tomatoes list of the best reviewed movies of the year.
Okay.
I think they make a list that's like 200 movies long or something. So,
all right.
You know, it's a kind of an interesting snapshot in terms of, I guess, whatever algorithm they use, which is which is useful to, you know, a very limited degree. But it got me thinking about the nature of list making and what we mean when we talk about, you know, the best movies of the year. When you look at the film critic list out there, there's kind of a split. Some people will say, you know, they're very open. These are my favorite movies of the year. These are the things that connected to me. And the same with book reviewers and music reviewers and so forth. And then some people seem to be making quite a quite a stance, making the argument that these are the best movies of the year. Where do you, I think I know what you're going to, how you're going to answer this, but where do you, what's your take on your approach to list making of this sort?
Well, I have to start with Emily Dickinson saying that the truth must dazzle gradually. When critics make their year-end lists, it's usually the height of Oscar season and a lot of things haven't opened yet. Some critics get chances to see most things before turn in their votes, but those votes are supposed to be turned in October, and chances are that some of the best things are going to sneak in just under the wire and may not open in most cities. Mm-hmm. They may only play a couple of times in L.A. and New York in order to qualify for Oscars, but that doesn't mean anybody's going to see them until February or March.
Right,
and if you don't have a lively movie community or a lot of screens in your town, you may not see them until they show up on streaming, and that can be years later.
So
I'm very, very skeptical about year-end lists and approach them very tongue-in-cheek, off of my own, very tongue-in-cheek with this sense that, you know, this is probably going to be a very different list in a year. And I give myself that luxury on my website. I update my lists all the time because I'm constantly seeing more things. I just saw one of my top five movies of 2017 just a few weeks ago, the Frederick Wiseman documentary about the New York Public Library finally became available on streaming services. And you know, when it played here in town, I think it only played it for a couple of screenings that I was out of town, so I missed it. I think that's one of the most important movies that came out last year, but hardly anybody has seen it. And even though it's readily available now, because it says 2017 on it, a lot of people are going to be like, oh, well, that's an old movie. But more importantly, our views of art change over time. I compare it to dating somebody. You know, when I see a movie for the first time, I feel like I have only just met them. When I see a movie a second time, I feel like I'm just starting to get to know them. And I'm beginning to get a sense of whether I want to pursue a relationship with this movie or not. But there really is a lot going on in the viewer that determines what the experience is going to be, because we come to art with our own personal histories and our fears and our questions and our preferences. And then there's also that struggle at a very primal level of getting past what my friend John Medina would call the animal instinct questions, which are, can I eat this or is this going to eat me? That's sort of the most primal question that occurs to your brain when you encounter anything. Is it a danger to me or can I overpower it? He says that the second or third question that occurs to your brain is, have I seen this before? And everything that follows from that, he says, tells you how much more sophisticated than just an animal you are. If you're just an animal, you're going to care that something be familiar and that something be something you can master or something that doesn't threaten or challenge you. But the more fully human we are, the more we are going to look for those challenges because we will understand that they can make us better. The more we are going to look for what is unfamiliar in order to expand our experience and become wiser and stronger and more empathetic. So what for me is a great movie is probably a movie that's going to make me profoundly uncomfortable the first time I see it because it's pushing against that reliance on nostalgia, that wanting things that are familiar and safe. And that's where the danger of sentimentality and becoming stuck in this, well, I may not know much about art, but I know what I like kind of response.
Yeah.
I think of that great Monty Python sketch where they're discussing the painting of the Last Supper, and there's this tug of war between wanting it to be full of what we like to see and wanting it to be true. So when I make these lists, a lot of people will push back and say, oh, you're just trying to be a critic or you're just trying to be sophisticated or you're trying to be a snob. And like, no, these, you know, I see 150 movies a year and the ones that mean the most to me are the ones that surprise me, challenge me, and make me want to go back and dig deeper rather than just the ones that send me out of the theater like, yes, that's what I like. So that's why there's a profound difference between kinds of lists. A lot of them are just sort of sentimental. These are my usual preferences lists. And a lot of them are, wow, that was something I've never experienced before. I don't understand it, but I know I want to think about it more. So that's what goes through my mind when I'm making lists. And I know that in a year, my thoughts about a particular movie will have changed because I probably will have gone back to it and discussed it and written about it. A lot of times I'll come out of a movie having loved it. And then when I sit down to write about it, I realize, you know, I sort of fell for the cliches in this one. And other times I'll come out going, oh my goodness, that was unpleasant. And I'll sit down and start to write about it and realize, well, it was unpleasant because it was true, because it was revelatory. And then I start to fall for it. What about you? I mean, do you make lists at the end of the year?
Well, I do make lists. I make them. I have the benefit of not having to publish them if I don't want to, I suppose. And I don't, you know, they can be very personal. I think that sometimes saves me from perhaps tending towards trying to impress people, so to speak. So I can focus on the one hand, I can focus on, you know, what movies that other people maybe don't like. I can just sort of, without having to worry about it, say, you know, for whatever reason I did like these, and then that allows me to think about what is it that I liked about it, and is it a flaw in me, or is it okay that I like something that maybe not a lot of other people liked, or that I didn't like something that everyone seems to be liking. I suppose if I was writing more about it as well, if I was spending more time actually having to write reviews of some of those movies that I either liked or didn't like, that a lot of that would come out before the list making process for me. So I have, that's probably something of a benefit, but I do make lists. I've found that I'm not seeing enough movies the year that they come out. You know, a lot of the things that came out this year that I'll end up loving, I probably won't get to see until the new year, because of the limitations of where I live, and then just having little kids, and it's hard for me to, you know, get out sometimes, enough times in a year to really make a comprehensive list. But then I'll go back later. I'll keep the list for 2018, and then I'll go back as I see them, sort of like what you were saying, and I'll cross things out and try to find ways to assess them after seeing things multiple times. But I mean, I love making lists. I keep a pretty detailed list of the books that I'm reading and the movies and TV that I'm watching throughout the year. And then like to look back at, you know, years later and see what I was reading or enjoying at a specific time. And I find often that because of the limitations that I'm working with, I find that I end up focusing a lot on, you know, the sort of essential and classic movies that I've missed or that I know that I need to rewatch again. So this year, for whatever reason, I found myself rewatching a lot of the classic American cinema of the 1970s. The French Connection and some of those sorts of movies that either I watched a long time ago when I was in college or, you know, studying film in school, or that I just missed altogether and felt like, you know, if I'm going to have educated conversations or even just feel like I know what I'm talking about or enjoying things within the right context, that I need to make sure that I see these things. So that is, you know, the limitations have forced me to some degree to spend more time on Filmstruck this year, although now I can't do that anymore, but
yeah, but you'll be able to again soon. It sounds like they've got a good replacement service coming up. And there are so many streaming options now. I'm a big fan of Canopy because they too are offering a lot of really wonderful, challenging films. That platform is built primarily for educators, and it's not as flashy and as user friendly as Netflix, but it's there's just a treasure trove there for people to find.
Yeah, in some ways, you know, like we'll talk about Roma in a little bit, but that's a movie that there's been a decent bit of discussion online about what's the best way to see it. And I think that the consensus take is that you see this in a theater if you can. And of course, that's how Alfonso Cuarón wanted us to watch it. But then there also is, you know, the streaming offers us access to the canon of movies, the great movies that 10 years ago when I was in college, for example, it was very difficult to find a lot of these movies. And I remember, for example, looking at a lot of the lists that you were making back then and, you know, that you'd made
oh, I don't know, going back into the 90s, right? So I'm looking
at in the late 90s, and I have recently that I have recently reorganized.
Well, I remember I graduated, I was in college in the mid 2000s. So I remember looking at those and looking at a lot of these lists that you were making, and there was a lot of foreign films on there, and I'd have to really hunt down trying to find some of those. And your list and a couple other people's lists were lists that I was using to kind of curate the movies that I was watching and that I wasn't getting in college in my classes. Yeah. And so it's a much easier to find some of those things because of these streaming services than it was then. So I'm very grateful for that. But I'm also trying to balance that with, you know, these movies were crafted to be seen in a very specific way. So I have to temper or adjust the way that I think about them because I'm either watching them, you know, on a TV or even, you know, God forbid, on my computer or iPad when I'm, you know, I've got a sleeping kid in the room and I'm just sort of waiting for them to not stir. So I'd have to, I'm trying to adjust the way I think about them and the way I judge them and assess them based on that.
Yeah. And a lot of that comes through discussion. I mean, I lived in just the right place at just the right time back then, because I lived in Seattle, which was a much better movie going town then than it is now. There were a lot more options, a lot more theaters. And I worked at a video store. So I had access to things that I,
what's a video store?
Yeah, exactly. What was that?
Although we do have a Family Video. I don't know if you guys know, if you know what that is. It's a Family Video around the corner from us that does free kids movies with rentals. So we have managed to see more kids movies than I would have ever expected, as long as I find a lot of older movies that are on DVD or Blu-ray that I can rent for a buck and then get a free kids movie. So that has definitely opened up some things that even, you know, kids movies that even I, you know, never saw that came out between the ages of when I was 15 and 25 before I had kids. So that's been fun to go back and watch kids movies that, well, quote, kids movies that I never saw that I love just as much as my kids do, if not more.
Yeah. And I've got a few kids movies on my list this year, so that's good.
Yeah, there's a couple that are getting quite a bit of positive. Well, all year long, there's been several that have been getting a lot of positive reviews. Yeah. But let's look at your list. Let's look at your top 10. But you mentioned that there are some honorable mentions that you'd like to that are worth talking about. They're getting, you know, the kind that are getting good reviews, and there's been a lot of buzz about them. So where would you like to start with? Which one?
Yeah, I'd say I've got a list of about 35 movies so far this year that I really enjoyed, but those that have just sort of missed the top 10, and that I might still put there in time as I continue to talk to people and revisit these films. But a few that I wished I could cram into the top 10 include some of the ones that people are talking about most right now. You mentioned Mission Impossible Fallout, which was a blast. A little movie called Puzzle that I wish more people had seen. It stars Kelly MacDonald, who most people know as the voice of Merida in Brave. I know her more as the main character in the movie Gosford Park, which is the movie that inspired Downton Abbey. Mm-hmm. She's an extraordinary actress, and this is the best role she's ever had. Puzzle is actually about a sort of a housebound housewife who discovers, of all things, competitive jigsaw puzzling. And that sounds immediately like a movie that's going to fall right into a formula about somebody who's going to find a life outside of her oppressive traditional family and find her way to fame and glory. And that's not what happens at all. It's a very complicated human story with a very sympathetic husband and kids and family. And yet a really sincere story about finding the courage to be yourself in that context, rather than just live up to other people's expectations. So Puzzle is a movie I really recommend that you track down for one of those quieter, more intimate movie going experiences. I loved it. Roma, which is maybe the most talked about movie this week, the new film from Alfonso Cuarón, who made Gravity and Children of Men, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, which I think is the best Harry Potter movie and one of the most well-crafted fantasy films ever made. First Reformed, the new film from Paul Schrader, which revisits a lot of the themes of his of Taxi Driver, which he wrote in the 70s, and updates it to be about a profoundly conflicted pastor who is torn between the people pleasing of a mega church and the gospel serving of his calling, in the middle of a big debate over global warming and pollution and environmentalism. And he sort of takes up the cause of serving God by devoting himself to creation care. And that leads him right off a cliff into cynicism about the church, about the state of the profoundly conflicted state of politics within the church. And really it comes down to what does the gospel really ask of us, and how easily can we go wrong when we start to despair. That movie has generated a lot of discussion this year. And a little movie called Prospect, which is a science fiction film by some new filmmakers named Zeke Earle and Chris Caldwell, who I have a personal connection to. They graduated from Seattle Pacific while I was working here. And so I've seen them go from aspiring undergraduate filmmakers with big ideas to actually making a big screen science fiction film that's really quite impressive and getting very good reviews. So I know it's not just that I'm biased. I also really love... I really love handmade filmmaking, and Prospect is unique in that it relies only where it absolutely has to on digital animation. And almost everything in the movie was handcrafted to create this sense of another world. And I've seen it twice, and I just really love it. But anyway, back to Roma, the most discussed film this week. Cuarón is nothing if not ambitious. And in this film, he's looking back at the style of great masters like Fellini and Bresson. And it's a panoramic widescreen black and white experience. But it's also a portrait of true love, really, for the character of this nanny who clearly represents women he knew growing up and experiences he had as a child, where the nanny really became the mother in the family. And she's so neglected and persecuted, and yet she's made a saint in this movie. And that is all very impressive. The reason it's not in my top 10, and I know I'm going to be really in the minority there as film critics go, is that so much of the discussion about the film is just how awestruck everyone is by the scope and the scale of these scenes, which are filmed often where you can see like miles into the distance, and there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of actors on the screen at the same time for scenes of riots in the streets, or scenes of a martial arts training ground, or scenes where the camera just goes and goes through the city, and you cannot imagine how they staged such massive sequences. And the reason that it's not in my top 10 is just that I spent so much time detached from the movie, thinking about it from a technical standpoint, that I realized afterwards that something really didn't work for me. It's supposed to be an intimate portrait celebrating the, excuse me, the big heart in this small woman, and how she was sort of an overlooked saint in the middle of all of this. And I came away from the movie not feeling like I had shared much experience with her at all. I had spent so much time being impressed with the technical achievement of the movie that I didn't feel close to the character the way the filmmaker wanted me to. And so that's why I'm in a very different place than a lot of other critics who can't stop talking about this achievement. Maybe the second time will be the charm for me. Maybe I'll see it again. And because now I've been overwhelmed the way he wanted me to be overwhelmed, maybe now I'll finally actually be able to pay attention to the character. But I found it both impressive and distancing. In a similar way, First Reformed as a movie was so busy referencing other movies, other great art films, in almost every case, better art films, that I spent most of my experience watching First Reformed thinking about other movies instead of thinking about the central character. So that it may be a problem with me in that I've seen too many movies and I've read too much about movies, and so I have a harder time with suspension of disbelief. I think they're both important films, but I've got to be honest as a critic about what really moved me. And the two questions that I ask coming out of a movie are, A, did I believe it while I was watching it? And B, what does this movie love most? And in the case of Roma, it felt to me like the movie professed love for its character, but really what it loved was pulling off amazing spectacles. And in the case of First Reformed, it seemed like it wanted me to love theological questions, but I came away feeling like the movie loved even more showing off its connection to other famous films. And that's where I'm conflicted on both of those.
In a strange reversal, at least regarding Roma, do you think that it's possible that watching it, you know, on Netflix or something like that, where the grandeur of the achievement, the technical achievement, is perhaps less pronounced and less profound, would actually maybe enhance the degree to which the female character, this saintly character, is put forth? Is that possible, or am I?
I suppose that's possible, but I think it's unlikely, because you're still seeing that entire image, and she will just get smaller and smaller. And in a lot of ways, you won't be able to appreciate the exquisite detail of those massive shots where you're looking across an open valley where there are hundreds of martial arts students training. And you can see each one of them distinctly on a smaller screen. You're going to lose a lot of that, and it's just going to be a really crowded, complicated image. Maybe I'll watch it and I'll feel more connected to the character, but it's not like if you watch it on TV, things are suddenly going to shift into close up. That doesn't happen at all. There is a sequence at the end on the beach, and I'm not going to spoil anything about it. Just say it's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. I really don't know how they did it. At the same time, there again, I'm focusing on how they did it, not what happened.
Like the famous shot in Atonement, the famous long take on the beach in Atonement, where everyone's sort of like, well, that was quite the achievement, but it didn't really hold the emotional weight that they probably wanted it to.
You know, come to think of it, that was pretty much my review of that film, was I spent the whole time thinking about how they made the movie instead of what it was about.
Do you find that that's true from, like, when you look at Gravity, do you have a sort of similar take on it? Did you have the same feeling that it was sort of masterfully created, but maybe soulless?
Soulless, I would say, is too harsh, because I do think he really cares about the central character's experience in that film. And in fact, Roma makes a direct reference to an experience that must have been a strong, influential personal experience for Cuarón. But it's almost like for about 5 minutes of the movie, he hits pause on Roma and says, and by the way, let me show you where I got the idea for Gravity. Because once again, it's a movie about a woman who's sort of lost in space, so to speak. She's trying to navigate in these extremely harsh conditions where one wrong move can ruin her entire life. And she's trying to maintain a connection with a sense of home that is very far away. So it's not real obvious, but you can make a strong correlation between the two movies. But there is one moment where it's very clear that we're getting a sense of the moment in very, very young Cuarón's life that planted the seed in him to make a movie about literally being lost in space. Back to your question, I really connected powerfully with the Cuarón movies that came before Gravity. Gravity was the one where I felt like technique and spectacle were beginning to overpower personal connection. I have a stronger connection to the movie Children of Men, stronger connection to Prisoner of Azkaban, frankly. And going back even earlier, a very strong connection to a children's movie called A Little Princess, which is a beautiful adaptation of a classic story that achieves real intimacy with its characters.
Interesting that you mentioned that, because those three movies that you just mentioned, none of them are original Cuarón stories.
True. They're all adaptations. That's right.
I wonder if that connection is because it's not all up to him to create that connection. I mean, Children of Men is obviously, that's a pretty incredible novel by a masterful storyteller.
Yeah, but the movie has little or nothing to do with it.
Well, true.
When I interviewed him about that film, he admitted that he had only read the text on the back of the book, like the synopsis, and said, "Oh, that gives me an idea for a movie," and he took it from there. So all of the arguments about how faithful the movie is to the book are kind of beside the point, because he didn't even try. He took the central idea and made his own thing out of it.
Yeah, it's interesting how even the seed of a story, though, seems to have given him like a sort of a something to work towards, or some sort of something to build his technical skills around or towards, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah.
Well, okay. So you mentioned First Reformed. I do have one question about that. Are you with sort of the, well, I guess it's not a consensus because he didn't get nominated for a Golden Globe, I don't believe, but are you in agreement that Ethan Hawke's performance is as good as everyone says?
Oh, he's great. He's great. And I won't begrudge him winning a Best Actor Oscar, which he may well. And he's also sort of got that, he's got it coming kind of vibe. He's starred in so many great things over the years. Frankly, I wish he had won for one of the three Richard Linklater films before Sunrise, Before Sunset, Before Midnight.
I think he deserved it for Midnight.
Yeah. I don't think it's his best performance, but I think it's a strong one in a year that lacked strong lead male performances, at least in the movies that people saw. Mm. So.
Yeah. It seems like some of the best, maybe we can talk about this at the end, but some of the best male performances this year were in pretty quiet movies and oftentimes by actors who we've never heard of before.
Definitely.
You know, whether that's, was it Ryder or is that what it's called?
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. The writer, Brady Giandro, basically playing himself. But that's a very powerful, memorable performance. There's a really strong performance by John C. Reilly in a Western that hardly anybody saw called The Sisters Brothers.
That's one I did see.
Yeah. That's a very strange film. I liked that a lot, partly because I can't wait to see it again to try to figure out what it's really about.
Yeah.
Joaquin Phoenix has Joaquin Phoenix in it.
Yeah.
Who shows up in my list in a different film, but we'll get to that.
Okay. Well, let's dive in a little deeper then. That's a good segue. So number 10, what's your number 10 movie on your favorite movies of the year?
10 right now is a movie called Private Life, which anybody who has Netflix can watch right now. It's a Netflix
movie, right? Well, Tamara Jenkins, is that?
Yeah. Catherine Hahn, who's also in my favorite movie of the year, but we'll get to that.
Okay.
Catherine Hahn and Paul Giamatti play a married couple who started their marriage as aspiring artists who were developing some sense of success and acclaim. And now, as they're getting older, they have decided a little bit late that they want to become parents. And so they are going through the madness of, and I say the madness because that's the perspective of the film, the madness of fertility treatments in every way, shape, or form. They're pursuing adoption and pursuing having a baby on their own. And the movie seems to come from, I don't know if it's the filmmaker's personal experience, but seems very based in true life experiences as they learn the ins and outs of these different kinds of treatments and start running into things like fraud, start learning just how many things can go wrong in that journey. And so as they are trying to sort of fill this void in their life, they come up against different prejudices within her family. And they start trying to help the woman Catherine Hahn plays, Rachel, they try to help her niece, who is in college and who is really kind of lost, trying to find who she is in the world. And as they become sort of a helpful uncle and aunt to her, they don't seem to realize the very parental role they are playing in her life. But the movie leaves it for us to see how they are really becoming a family, even as they ask her to help them in their search for a child. And she, being a very empathetic soul, wants to help them. It's very funny, but funny in that laugh of recognition kind of way. Mm. It's painful truth. And I have never liked Paul Giamatti more in a movie, and I'm a big fan of Paul Giamatti. He is such a fully developed human character here. Catherine Hahn, who's better known for comedies like Bridesmaids, is spectacular here. I think she's got a very promising future as a dramatic actress. Above all, I'm just happy to see Tamara Jenkins back as a filmmaker. She made a movie called The Savages. Gosh, like a decade ago with Laura Linney and Philip Seymour Hoffman that was absolutely fantastic. So welcome return for Tamara Jenkins. And I highly recommend this to you, but I might not recommend it as a date movie because it is a very honest, raw, difficult movie about the challenges of marriage and that the risks you take for your heart and your mental health if you set out on this kind of quest at this point in your life.
I suppose I should mention as a disclaimer here that many people who are listening will be thinking about watching movies with their kids and families. So just do a little research, as I'm sure you're going to, and be discerning. Yes. Be discerning as you use your own discernment based on your kids, because we're not going to be able to tell you whether or not every one of these movies is great for your family. So
this is not a family movie. It's a movie that cares very deeply about families,
but
maybe, it is not a family movie.
Yeah, not one to watch with the kids. So number 10 is Private Life, Tamara Jenkins movie. So number 9.
Number nine right now on my list is a movie called Leave No Trace. I'm just now realizing that's also from a female director who we haven't heard from in a long time, Deborah Granick. She made the movie Winter's Bone, which was the movie that sort of introduced Jennifer Lawrence to the world as an actress and launched her career in a very big way. And frankly, I don't know that I've liked a performance from Jennifer Lawrence more than the one that she gave in Winter's Bone. Winter's Bone, of course, was a very raw, terrifying movie about a young woman in an impossible situation in a very rural area where the community can become as much a danger to you as a support. That is also true in this movie, which is called Leave No Trace. It stars Thomasin McKenzie, who I think has as promising a future as Jennifer Lawrence, perhaps. She plays the daughter of a war veteran who, because of PTSD, is now living in the forest, the big forest park just outside of Portland, Oregon, where I grew up. So a lot of this area looks very familiar to me. He wants to live off the grid. He's very paranoid. He's very suspicious of the government. But he's also very legitimately upset about the effects of consumerism on individuality and on freedom. And so he wants his daughter to grow up free from all of that influence and meddling, and he wants an authentic life. So he's trying to teach her survival. He's trying to teach her an appreciation for the natural world and for beauty. And there is an intimacy between the two of them that we rarely ever see between a father and a daughter in a film. Both characters are so fully developed. Ben Foster plays the father, and he usually plays really scary, nasty, dangerous guys. But here he's capable of that, but he's also just a very broken soul that you can deeply care for. This movie follows them in a trajectory where we know they cannot sustain this because they're being hunted. They are desperately in need of mental health support for him. She is in need of good schooling and good care, so she's going to be able to survive in the real world. And so it's really about navigating that tension between the ways in which society wants to shape you and your need for community, your need to participate in society. It's sort of like that great Thomas Merton life lesson about the importance of solitude in order to hear yourself think. But then even more, the challenge to go and participate in society and be Christ to the world, carrying that sense of solitude and self-knowledge with you into the world. It's a really beautiful film, and I highly recommend it for the performances and for Deborah Granick just as a director. I hope we don't have to wait 10 more years for another one from her.
I have heard some great things about Thomasin McKenzie, and She's Australian, isn't she?
Yes, she's she's already involved in other projects, and I'm really eager to see how that works out for her, to see if she has the kind of range that Jennifer Lawrence has proven to have. I'm actually a big fan of Jennifer Lawrence, but the more that celebrity has become a part of her career, the harder it has become to believe her in a movie, because we sit there thinking about the celebrity. It's like that. It's like Michael Caine said to me in an interview a long time ago. He said, if you're sitting there thinking that's a great performance by Michael Caine, then I have failed. He says, you should be caught up in the character, not thinking about me.
Man, what a challenge, though, for someone who gets as famous as, say, a Tom Cruise or even a Tom Hanks or someone like that.
Right. Yeah. Then the movies become about them and their career and how this character is a challenge for them. And it's very rare that we forget who we're watching and we're completely caught up in the suspension of disbelief.
There's been a lot of talk about the way, I mean, I haven't seen this movie yet. There's been a lot of talk about the way that Christian Bale becomes the vice president in Vice. Yes. Well, not the current vice president, you know. But have you seen Vice?
Not yet. But I think it's probably a wise marketing endeavor to focus on that transformation, because the early reviews of the film are pretty terrible. And if anybody's going to end up seeing it, it's going to be because they want to see Christian Bale turn into Dick Cheney.
It's interesting. Man, that's got to be, you know, for he's the kind of character, or he's the kind of actor who tends to, you know, really do a transformation like that. You know, he's going to gain the weight or lose the weight or put on the strange voice or whatever. And Daniel Day-Lewis did the same thing, but it seems like there's a fine line there between a really profound performance and just sort of almost becoming a caricature of your own career, I guess.
Yeah. Some people call it stunt acting. It's like, look what I can do now.
Yeah. That's Johnny Depp, right?
Yes.
It does seem to be, at least the way he's gone.
In recent years. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Number eight. So 10 is Private Life. 9 is Leave No Trace. And,
I have to do some disclaimers here on 8, 7, and 6, because technically they did play at least on one screen somewhere in the world in 2017, but they didn't become accessible. And some of them actually are still difficult to find. Number 8 is a film called November. And November is set in a medieval Estonian town, full of very, very poor, messy, crude peasants who are caught up in the occult. This is a story that's really a folk tale. It's like a fairy tale come to life on the screen, but it's like a fairy tale if it was made by the great Russian filmmaker Andrei Tarkovsky. Everything is rain-drenched and muddy.
That's quite the comp.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an extravagant black and white photography experience, first and foremost. The reason I love it is because it brings fairy tale imagery to life in black and white photography in ways that just left my jaw on the floor. And while that may sound like the very thing I was criticizing Roma for, in this case, I was completely enchanted. The story is very simple in a way. At times, almost too simple. I actually felt a little bit dissatisfied at the end because I wanted the story to end up being a little more complicated. But I think the filmmakers are very dedicated to a certain kind of ancient storytelling. And so you have a young peasant boy who is obsessed with and sort of lusting over this rich, very stuck up, very pretentious woman who's probably going to use and abuse him. But he, the boy, is loved by another peasant girl who becomes sick with jealousy and who ends up conspiring with a witch to try and spoil this boy's quest to win the heart of the rich girl. And so, as you can imagine, things get very dark and strange. But the film does acknowledge the presence of a very crude understanding of Christianity in the community. And so it shows how Christianity can be corrupted and become just another vocabulary for personal advancement if you're not careful. And it really is a wages of sin kind of story, because while the sin on display is very dark and troubling, the movie does not glorify it at all. So again, not a movie for the family, not a movie for small children, but if you're interested in the darker origins of fairy tales and the profound lessons in good and evil that they can offer, this is a really incredible work of imagination. It's called November. You can rent it on streaming platforms like voodoo.com, ironically, although it's V-U-D-U, not voodoo, V-O-O-D-O-O, but voodoo.com. That's where I saw it. And as a big fan of fantasy and fairy tales, I thought it was the best visual experience at the movies I had this year.
What would you compare it to? Like, is there some movie throughout you know, the history of, well, I don't know, the history of film, a big question, but that maybe that's something that people have seen before, or maybe some kind of, maybe a couple of movies that it pays homage to in any ways.
If you've seen Jean Cocteau's classic Beauty and the Beast, I mean, okay. The old black and white Beauty and the Beast, which has images achieved with practical effects and black and white photography that are just magical. I suppose I could compare it to something like that, but that's a much more childlike, that's a movie that I would show to children.
Right.
This is a much grittier kind of thing. Like I said, it has that Tarkovsky dirtiness to it, where it feels like you have discovered a sort of cult in the woods. I guess as far as the spirit of the thing, it reminds me most of a horror movie that came out a year ago called The Witch.
Okay.
Not quite as graphic as that film, but close. And there are monsters in this movie that the forces of evil bring to life, and they are built out of the stuff that the people have around the farm. So there's almost a Tim Burton kind of element to it, where this monster is running around the countryside, and he's made out of, I want to say, like a scythe and an axe and a wagon wheel and the skull of a cow or a horse or something. So there are these very strange animated characters somersaulting around the landscape in the background. And that adds a very surreal aspect to it.
Mm. Is this where was it made? Is this I'm looking it up right now.
Well, it takes place in a medieval Estonian village. I'm not familiar with the director. I need to do more reading about him, but his name is Rainier Sarnet or Sarnay.
Estonia.
Yes.
He's Estonian. Okay.
So yeah, not like anything you will have seen before.
You're not going to see it at your multiplex?
Absolutely not. No, I think it did play one screen in Seattle for a short time, but I caught up with it on a streaming platform.
All right. So Private Life, number 10, number 9, Leave No Trace, number 8, November. So we're at number 7 now.
Moving right along. 24 Frames is a movie that I'm probably not going to recommend to your listeners because it will probably put most people to sleep. But it's important to me because it's the last movie by the great Iranian filmmaker Abbas Kiarostami. Mm. And it's a unique movie going experience. It's 24 still photographs that he took and wanted to share that were deeply personal to him. And they're usually photographs of landscapes. And you may wonder, okay, I'm going to a movie theater. I'm going to look at 24 still photographs. How is that even a movie? He gave these photographs of often snowy landscapes with crows and ravens hopping around in the trees and herds of cattle or horses or wild animals. And he gave those photographs to special effects artists. So as you sit and look at this still photograph on the big screen, it slowly comes to life in very subtle ways. So you're looking, it's almost like looking at the most beautiful collection of animated GIFs that have been made. And the more you watch, the more you realize there actually are thematic connections between the images. And he is talking to you about the world. He is talking to you about human nature. He is talking to you about the threats to the planet. He's talking about deeply spiritual things, but he relies on us to think about what we're watching and consider the questions that they raise, consider matters of predators and prey and the fragility of the environment and the purpose of the seasons. It was an extraordinary experience. I'll never forget it. There were only about 10 of us in the theater, and I think two or three of them left by about the third photograph. But I found it kind of hypnotic and mesmerizing. And it's sort of a reminder, a useful reminder, I think, that motion pictures, we tend to talk about the story primarily. But you can take the story away and still have a movie. You can't take away imagery and still have a movie. And it reminds you that the elemental thing about cinema is powerful, carefully composed images that speak in ways that we are, like we are right now, struggling to paraphrase. That's what makes it's a high art and a very different one than just storytelling. So 24 frames was the most unique thing I saw this year. And I've just learned that the Criterion Collection is going to be releasing it soon. So that means it found enough critical consensus that this was an important achievement in cinema. And one that, if you're up for a challenge, watch it on the biggest screen you can find with the best sound system you can find, so you can lose yourself in these environments.
And that one is available.
That one is Criterion. Not available currently. It will be out as a Criterion release soon. But I saw it during a limited engagement screening here in Seattle, and it did very well at film festivals. If you do a Google search for 24 frames, you're going to find all kinds of rave reviews about it. My friend Melissa Taminga, who lives up in Bellingham, Washington, and who is a film critic for the Seattle Scene and also a frequent guest on the podcast Film Spotting, she picked 24 frames as her number one movie of the year. She was overwhelmed by it. So
The trailer, what would you say the trailer gives a taste of?
Yes,
an actual taste.
That'll tell you whether this is something you want to pursue or not.
Some trailers, you know, maybe not. This one sounds like it will.
Yeah, I don't recommend it because I have any confidence it's going to be a crowd pleaser. I recommend it in the hopes that maybe one listener will find it and think, wow, this enhances my understanding of what movies can do. And maybe it'll inspire some visual artists to realize that cinema, they don't have to have a story to make a movie. The movies can work on us in very different ways.
And in some cases, sometimes there's too much story anyway, right? So yes. I was following some threads on Twitter recently, film critics discussing the way that so many movies are so long. And so when you run across one, you know, that's a really confident hour and a half, you know, that's just, there's an efficiency to it and a precision to it, that's a really welcome thing in a world where so many movies and even TV shows seem so bloated. And so they feel like they have to pack so much story when sometimes, you know, a single image could do just as well as 25 minutes of exposition.
You're going to hear a lot about a movie called Widows that people are putting on their top 10 lists. And I didn't put that anywhere near my top 10 list because I felt like it so clearly needed to be a miniseries. It wanted to be like The Wire. It wanted to be a social studies experience. And the fact is, it's based on a miniseries, on a British television series. And I think that's the real weakness in that movie, is it doesn't go deep on anything because it's trying to include everything.
There's that shot in that movie, you know, the one that everyone's talking about, the long take where the camera's kind of on the hood of the car and they're driving from the sort of slum part of Chicago. And then it takes 3.5 minutes or whatever it is to get to the rich part. And that was one of those scenes that you can see what they're going for. And as I was watching it, it was, you know, there's something of an achievement there, and it just all felt sort of on the nose, as some people say. And that's one of those movies that I feel like has moments, but the moments don't add up to what it seems to think of that they add up to.
Exactly. Yeah. Steve McQueen, the director, is very, very good at visual composition and creating a sort of a mood with the lighting. And that particular scene was one of the most interesting things in the movie to me. But that's because it gave me something great to look at, because the story really wasn't involving me very much.
I thought there were, you know, like Brian Tyree Henry, I thought had the scene where he's in the apartment. I thought that was interesting, the way he's sort of becoming an actor to look out for. And of course, I haven't seen If Beale Street Could Talk yet. But, you know, there's certain moments or certain interactions that are enjoyable in the moment. And then you kind of look back at them and feels like, well, what did it all mean?
Right. I'm glad you brought up If Beale Street Could Talk, because that's one of the ones that I can't wait to see, and I haven't seen yet either. I'm still playing catch up on some of these. But he does figure in another of my top 10 here, so we'll get to that.
Well, okay, let's get there. Number six.
Number six, again, one that I'm not going to highly recommend to everybody, because this is a very dark, disturbing, and violent film. It's called You Were Never Really Here. Mm. And that also is by a great female director. This is a great year for women who make movies. Lynn Ramsey, who has made some of the most critically acclaimed movies of the last 30 years. This is a movie with Joaquin Phoenix, and it also has Taxi Driver connections the way First Reform does. It's about a man who is so damaged by past experiences with violence that he is trying to channel his mental illness in a way into some form of productive vigilante justice. So he hunts down criminals who kidnap children and who are involved in human trafficking. So it's about this traumatized war veteran trying to find a missing girl. And the more he looks for her, the more he uncovers this web of political corruption. And it takes him eventually right into the heart of a human trafficking effort that is very, very hard to see and to think about. And the movie does not flinch at showing some of the horrific abuse going on there. But what the movie, I think, is really about is our addiction to the idea of a vengeful male champion going in to rescue vulnerable women or girls and becoming a hero that way. In this movie, it can look very much like a formula on the surface. Here's a guy who's angry, you know, like Liam Neeson in so many movies in the last several years. And he's going to go find the girl they took and he's going to make them pay. And this movie forces you to deal with the implications of that. And also questions this whole assumption that this is a man's job. I don't want to spoil any of the storytelling turns, but by the end, if men who watch this movie find any kind of satisfaction or sense of identity in this role of being the hero who goes and rescues princesses who are locked in towers, this movie really confronts that and will leave them asking why that is what gives them a sense of identity, because our hero, quote unquote hero, ends up profoundly disillusioned with this path he has chosen for himself by the end. And it leaves us asking if, maybe sometimes the quote unquote princesses are fully aware of what they're caught up in and are capable of responding to that situation themselves. If the world empowers them with the possibility that they can. So again, a very dark, sort of nightmarish film, but one that exposes questions, challenges us with questions that I think are really important, and that can ultimately signal a major transition in American storytelling away from this glorification of vigilante justice Yes, exactly. Yeah, a turn away from the Mel Gibson era, so to speak.
I'm really glad you've mentioned that. So many, what was that, three of the five movies you mentioned so far were by female directors? Because if you look around, if you just look at the big movies right now, so to speak, even the ones that got nominated, or even the directors who got nominated for Golden Globes and who are in the running for the Academy Award, there is certainly a lack of women in those lists, but there are some really incredible female directors working right now. And I hope people, you said you couldn't recommend all of these movies, and I get why, but I also hope people go see these movies or find a way to watch them, because so many of these directors deserve, the platform that some of these other, they probably deserve it more than a lot of these, a lot of the men who just continuing to put out mediocre movies one after the other. If we gave some of that money to these women who are making incredible movies, think about how much better the world of movies would be.
Well, and a shout out to Chloe Zhao, who made The Rider, which is not in my top 10, but which is one of my favorite films of the year. She made a movie that's almost a documentary because it's about this guy who suffered a traumatic head injury as a rodeo rider. And she met this guy and wanted to tell his story, but told it as a sort of fictionalized it. So that we're left to wonder how much of it is really Brady Jandro's true story and how much of it was crafted for the sake of a movie experience. But she's so intimate with her characters and with that community. I can't wait to see what she does next. So there are several new voices in film, new visions in film this year that I can't wait to see what else they do.
And I don't want to, you know, there are several female directors who are getting, you know, Greta Gerwig, for example, is getting more and more options for things she's going to do. She's going to be bringing out Little Women, which has a pretty interesting cast attached to that. So,
yeah,
I don't want to say
I loved Lady Bird. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let's move on. Number five.
All right. When you get into the top five, these are all from men who are filmmakers. That really has no bearing on the fact that I like them. But it's a good place to sort of transition our focus here, because I think in the top five, four of them have to do with young people. Four of them have to do either with bringing an audience of adults into a renewed appreciation for and hopefully restoration of childlike wonder and faith. But also helping us think about the world we are giving to the next generation. What kind of world have we made for children? What kind of experience are children having? So number five on my list is Won't You Be My Neighbor, the documentary you mentioned earlier about Fred Rogers.
Yeah.
I grew up watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He was a hero to me. I wanted to be a puppeteer. I wanted to be a storyteller like him. I wanted to have my own TV show like him. he influenced me in many, many ways.
Have you accomplished any of those things yet? I mean, maybe you could get a puppeteering TV show as well.
Well, I'm on a podcast, so I'll leave that to you to decide how close I came. But I do continue to write stories, and I do still love puppets. In fact, my writing desk at home in my writing office is a puppet stage that my grandfather built for me when I was 10 years old.
And that's fantastic.
Since I don't do puppet shows anymore, I had my father sort of convert it into a laptop desk so I can sit at the puppet stage and bring characters to life. a lot of that goes back to my love for Mr. Rogers and for Jim Henson. It'd be easy for me to say, of course I love this movie. It's very personal to me, and it is. But boy, I tell you, looking around in the theater at how many people were just openly weeping at this vision of a man who is so empathetic and imaginative and caring and conscientious, and really a living manifestation of the gospel in many, many ways. This is a Presbyterian minister who chose to be a children's TV personality instead of to be a pastor. And the influence he had on our generation, but also on new generations. I thinking that this was probably something that I couldn't review fairly, I asked my students, undergraduates in college, what they thought of it. And they cried too. They'd never seen the show, but this movie is so well crafted that it gave them a profound encounter with Mr. Rogers and enables his ministry to go on. I think ministry is the right word for it, in a way that we desperately need right now. There was a sense in the audience watching Won't You Be My Neighbor that this is exactly the movie the world needs right now, because it will remind us of those lessons we learned in childhood about loving your neighbor, loving the stranger, loving the person who isn't like you, and how that is at the core of whether there's any hope for the world. So as you watch Fred Rogers, who seems so irrepressibly hopeful and optimistic and loving, as you watch his spirit broken by things that are happening in the world, it ends up being a very unsettling experience in some ways. It could have just been a Valentine to Mr. Rogers, but it's a really unsettling psychological portrait of what is happening to the best of us in the world. In the world that we are creating, in the world that some of our, I mean, for lack of a better word, consumerist tendencies are shaping. a lot of people in their reviews are saying, you know, Fred Rogers would never succeed in the world today, would never have that kind of TV show in the world today, because we've lost an appreciation for paying attention. We've lost an appreciation for silence. We've lost an appreciation for intimacy. We want to be constantly, jarringly entertained. And his kind of ministry would not survive in this kind of world. And so I think it's not just a feel-good movie. It's a profoundly challenging one.
I think it was A.O. Scott who called it curiously melancholy or something like that. I thought that was a really good way of putting it. That, I believe it's streaming on Amazon Prime Video right now, I think. And if it's not, you can rent it for a couple of dollars for people who haven't seen that one yet.
If I could take the whole world to see one movie this year, that's the one I would take them to. Absolutely.
I've been, side note, I've been pleasantly surprised at the degree to which my boys, they're 6 and 7, and then I've got a 2-year-old as well, but how much they have loved Mr. Rogers. I wasn't sure, because of the things that are available to them now. And, you know, I was hopeful, you know, we've been pretty careful about what we sort of curate for them, but I've been pleasantly surprised at how much they actually, I think that his temperament is appealing to young children. And I think that that's true in 2018 as much as it was in the, you know, early 90s when I was growing up, or, you know, in the 30s when you were growing up or whatever.
back then.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on. Number four.
Closely connected. This is a movie called Eighth Grade, written by the stand-up comedian Bo Burnham, who somehow, I don't know how, has a direct line into the emotional experience of a middle school girl and is able to bring to life what life is like now for middle schoolers or middle school girls, or at least this white middle class middle schooler, who is living and growing up in a world saturated by social media, where her social media environment is more real to her in many ways than her physical environment. And so we are watching, as she sort of keeps a video diary, we are drawn into the striking and unsettling dichotomies between the way she presents herself in her world and the way she sort of advises others on her YouTube channel, and the deeply alienating experiences she's having at school, where she just cannot connect with people around her very well. On the other hand, it's also an inspiring picture of how the creative expression involved in presenting herself on social media ends up being a sort of therapy. She's obviously advising herself when she advises others on her YouTube channel. And so we can watch her sort of coaching herself for lack of having a good coach in her life. Having said that, it would be very easy for this movie to have made her single parent father just a joke. But he also is a very loving, caring man who is just, who's trying to figure out how to be a good father to this young woman. And I loved it. I thought I completely believed in the world. Back to those two questions I ask of a movie. Do I believe it? I absolutely believed in 13-year-old Kayla. I absolutely believed in her dad, played by Josh Hamilton. And I remember a lot of these experiences from middle school, a lot of those insecurities and fears. Probably the best scene in the movie involves Kayla trying to muster the courage to go to a swimming pool party. And she doesn't want to go because she's worried about her body. She's worried about swimsuits. She's worried about being so exposed and vulnerable, surrounded by all of these others who seem so confident and so in control, when of course they're not.
Right.
And boy, that brought back nightmare flashbacks for me. I had a similarly traumatic experience at one of those parties. So I think it's a fantastic movie for anybody, just to remind us of the world that we're giving young people like this. But it's also, I think, inspiring for young people to watch and see the lessons that Kayla learns along the way, the surprising influence of an older girl who sort of becomes a mentor to her and becomes kind of a guardian angel to her. Very unlikely turn. I thought that was going to go very, very wrong in the movie, but it doesn't. And Bo Burnham, I mean, didn't really know him before, but this stand-up comic has come out of nowhere to make one of the most fully realized memorable movies of the year for me. So I highly recommend that. And that also now is available for rental on streaming platforms. Very worthwhile. Although if you're going to watch it with your kids, be informed that there is a moment in the movie where young Kayla, in her attempts to impress a boy she likes, digs a little too deep in the internet, so to speak, to figure out what boys want. And that's probably not a scene you want to watch with your kids.
Yeah, it might be at best awkward, I suppose. At best. Okay, so top three movies.
Yeah.
I have a feeling I know at least one of these are based on things I've seen you say over the course of the year. But I'll let you reveal them for me. So number three.
Number three is the odd one out here. Number three is not about kids at all. Number three is called The Favorite.
It was on my list to ask you. I got to ask you about this one.
Yeah, by Yorgos Lanthimos, who has made some of the strangest, most disturbing comedies of the last several years, including The Lobster.
Yep.
I'd rather not try to explain or describe those movies for you. That would take hours. The Favorite is a period piece set in the 18th century in the reign of Queen Anne, played by the great Olivia Colman, who some of you will know from Broadchurch.
She's going to be in The Crown.
Yes, well, which makes a whole lot of sense. She is one of the great British actors, and she will have the status of a Judi Dench someday. She plays Queen Anne, who is descending into madness, fractured with losses and regrets. The less I say about that, the better, because the way the movie reveals the nature of her losses is really one of its strong points. And it's about two women who are competing to be her right hand, or really to control her, because she's just incapable of ruling. Her judgment is so lost, and her understanding of what the nation needs is profoundly insufficient. So here comes, there's a woman named Sarah who is sort of her attendant, played by Rachel Weisz, who is really running the country, because she's able to influence Queen Anne so much and has found ways to win her favor. And then here comes Sarah's young cousin, Abigail, played by Emma Stone. And she is a rags to riches story who is going to compete with Sarah for the Queen's love and attention, and thus the title, The Favorite. But this is not Downton Abbey. This is or The Crown. This is a nasty, subversive, twisted picture of the corrupting nature of power. So while it sounds like a movie maybe I should be warning people about, well, that's fair. I should warn you. It's very dark and twisted. It's also very true, very truthful. It's a great movie to have in theaters right now, showing to big audiences, because of the picture it gives us of the how easily people are duped into compromising and into pleasing, shall we say, misguided leaders in order to gain influence, and what that actually does to a person. And so the more we might end up rooting for one of these characters to win the Queen's favor, by the end we're realizing, well, what have we been rooting for? I mean, to win in this game is to find yourself in prison, not necessarily a literal prison, but a psychological prison. The more power you gain in this situation, the more alienated you become from the world, and the more lonely you will become. So it's a very sick and twisted game. But again, I think it's disturbing for a reason, and for a good reason. It's purposeful. It's meaningful. It's hilarious. And also, I think, kind of a game changer in movies like this, because the women do not exist to win men's favor. The women have their own relationships that are stories unto themselves, and the power games that are power games unto themselves, and the men are almost irrelevant in this movie. So it would threaten and upset men who feel threatened when movies stop being primarily about them. But in that sense, I think it's therapeutic and very, very truthful. So I'm a big fan of this movie. The audience I saw it with loved it, laughed up a storm all the way to the end. But again, it's very R-rated because it's very truthful about very, shall we say, troubling things. Mm.
This is a movie that I have been looking forward to since I heard about it, because The Lobster was one of my favorite movie theater experiences I've seen in a long time. I drove with a friend of mine and my brother we drove pretty far. We kind of made a day, but we had lunch somewhere, and I'm not really sure why we wanted to see it so much, but we did. And we went to a matinee, and then I remember we had some very different responses to it. It just made for a very sort of fun movie going experience. You know, what you want movies to be like, where it just generates so much conversation and you sit there half the time wondering what's going on. And at least that's what that's one of the things I enjoy about movies that are as creative in the best way. I don't mean that's sort of a productive word to use, but it's his movies are so creative and so strange in the best ways that I can't wait to see this one. It's finally here in town this week, so I gotta steal some time away to go see that one. The trailer, I've watched the trailer probably 20 times just because I like the trailer in and of itself, so can't wait for that one.
You know, he takes these wild risks with his storytelling. I mean, The Lobster, he asks you to believe that if you don't follow society's rules, that the government will turn you into an animal. You know, I mean, that's ridiculous. But if you can accept that presence or that premise,
yeah,
then what that comes to represent or what that comes to say about society is actually quite truthful. And reminds me of what Nathaniel Hawthorne said about that the real measure of a work of art is in its suggestiveness. And Lanthimos's films take these wild risks in order to challenge us with metaphors. And if we accept the metaphor, we'll see that as far-fetched as this movie is, and The Favorite is not based on a lot of real history. There's a lot of make-believe going on here. But if we accept these crazy premises, we end up with things that can't be said, truths that can't be said any other way. So I'm grateful for him.
Quickly, would you consider it kind of a subversion of the typical, I don't know, chamber piece that...
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, it takes a lot of those conventions. Which man on the court does this woman need to charm in order to win her way? And just completely turns that upside down. It's very, very funny.
Well, like I said, I'm going to have to figure out how to see this before Christmas. Number two.
I think it's the best Emma Stone performance we've had yet. You know, she won an Oscar for La La Land, and I kind of cringed because I had a feeling that the great Emma Stone performance was probably just around the corner, and here it is.
She was scheduled to be in the Greta Gerwig Little Women, but then I saw that she's out because of promoting their filming while they had to promote The Favorite. That would have been, I would have really enjoyed seeing her in a movie directed by Greta Gerwig, but
it'll probably happen with some other movie then. Yeah.
All right. Number two.
Well, now we're back in kindergarten, so to speak. Paddington 2.
Yeah, I love this movie.
Maybe the best sequel I have seen since Toy Story 2. It's like Toy Story 2, embraces everything that went well with the first Paddington movie. Believe me, if you're hearing this and scratching your head and wondering what in the world I'm talking about, you need to see Paddington. Because Paddington, like the best Pixar movies, has all the stuff that it needs to be a great children's movie, but is speaking profoundly to adults. Mm-hmm. And it also unleashes such extraordinary visual imagination, such perfect voice casting.
Yeah. Ben Whishaw is incredible.
I don't know that I can think of a better voice match for a character than Ben Whishaw and Paddington. Sally Hawkins, who was in the movie The Shape of Water. Yeah. I thought she was even better in the Paddington movies.
Hugh Bonneville
from Downton Abbey, and just such a great cast. Paddington 2 is a much bigger and frankly better movie, and it's about how our communities are stronger if we welcome the stranger. So it's a very, very timely movie about England and immigration right now. It's about a bear who loves marmalade sandwiches, but it's about problems with prisons and incarceration and unfair police practices. And I mean, it's hard to believe all these things fit together so well. A lot of people have acknowledged that if you didn't see the director's name on this film, it's directed by Paul King, who also directed the first Paddington movie, you might end up concluding that it's a Wes Anderson movie. Because visually, it's so in love with symmetry and color and a sort of diorama-like pageantry. And I think that's a really good comparison. It also gets great, great work from all of its actors. And the real standout here, believe it or not, is Hugh Grant, who I think has the best role and best performance of his career as the villain in Paddington 2, believe it or not. So the less I say about that, the better, because this movie is full of surprises. It's so funny. It's so warm-hearted. It gets great performances from Brendan Gleeson as well. Yeah. Noah Taylor, who there's not enough Noah Taylor in the movies. I've seen it 3 times now. I just bought a copy for the home library because I know I'll keep going back to it. And as somebody who likes to write stories for children, I just hold this up as sort of a gold standard. It would have been my movie of the year until last week. So,
which brings us to your movie, your number one movie of the year. So it's a recent. Yeah,
I can't believe I'm saying this. And maybe in a year I will look back and go, what was I thinking? Because I typically don't like superhero movies. I think they justify a lot of things that trouble me. I think they're frustratingly formulaic. And I just think they've kind of taken over movies. And I'm just so very tired of Marvel movies. There are very few of them that have made much of an impression on me at all. But I saw Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. I have to laugh at myself just to say it out loud. Last week.
It's a great title.
And I have not had more fun at a movie since I was a kid. There is so much note-perfect humor, so many strong characters, and above all, just extravagant visual imagination in this movie that I'm just fumbling for other animated movies to compare to it. It has a huge cast of characters because the whole premise is that there are many different universes and there's a Spider-Man in all of them. And what if all of those Spider-Men ended up in the same place at the same time, trying to fight the same criminal, this gigantic villain called Kingpin, who is breaking down the walls between these universes? What if they all had to get together and accept the fact that there are other Spider-Men in the universe and then work together, fitting their differences together in order to achieve something? So it's a coming of age story about a young Afro-Latino boy named Miles Morales, who is the son of a cop. So there's all kinds of issues on the table already there in New York, which is overrun with consumerism and just capitalism run amok, trying to find his way in the world and discovers that he's been bitten by the same kind of spider that made the first Spider-Man. So he ends up meeting Peter Parker and they have to sort of negotiate, okay, how are we going to do this now that there's 2 of us? And then there are 3 and 4 and 5 and 6. And where it really gets creative is that these other Spider-Men are not just coming from other alternate universes, they're coming from other genres. So one of the Spider-Men, believe it or not, is like Porky Pig from a Looney Tunes version of Spider-Man. Who actually says that's all folks at one point in the movie. There's a Spider-Woman. There's a noir Spider-Man. And as these different genres collide, the visual styles associated with those different comics collide. Mm. And somehow, I'm still trying to figure out how they did it, the filmmakers keep us anchored, keep us focused on Miles Morales and his coming of age story in the middle of all of these mishmash styles on the screen. I cared about these characters. I was exhilarated by the music in this movie, which also comes from all kinds of genres. I didn't want to blink because there were so many wonderful things happening on the screen at once. And contrary to Roma and some of these other movies we've talked about, the technical achievement of the thing did not distract me from the heart of the movie. And I think it's about very, very important things all the way through. So I went and saw it a second time yesterday on a big IMAX screen. And this time I took a notebook with me and I sat there and I filled 7 pages with notes, just trying to keep up with little details that I was noticing the second time that contribute meaningfully to the heart of the movie. And I can tell you from experience that I'm going to find more the third time, and I'm going to find more the fourth time. This is a sense that I've developed over many, many years, that once in a while you just get that sense that this is one of those movies that's going to keep on rewarding us every time we go. All these other movies I've been talking about, which I really loved and really admired, none of them gave me that sense of, I can't wait to see this as many times as possible in a theater with an audience on the biggest possible screen, because it takes me back to why I fell in love with movies in the first place. I have that thrill that I felt seeing Raiders of the Lost Ark for the first time. I have that sense that this is a movie that's going to continue to inspire me to make my own stuff for years to come. Because it has reminded me that, you know, as saturated as we are with movies and television and imagery, there are still wonderful new ways to tell stories in meaningful ways. I think a lot of kids are going to be profoundly influenced by this film because of what it's saying to them and the what it's showing them. So, yeah, believe it or not, a movie that I was cynical about when I first saw the trailer is the one that I hope to see several more times in the theater before it's gone. So it's a big commercial movie. It's got Sony stamped all over it. There's Sony products all over this thing. But somehow they gave this project to just the right people who love comic books, who love Spider-Man so much, and who really get what those stories can mean to people. And allowed them the freedom to develop this vision over time so that it is worth digging into. So that's it. That's my movie of the year. And I doubt that anything is going to take its place,
but that is a, you know, good holiday season family movie.
Yes. Yes, I think so. In fact, where most Spider-Man movies are about Spider-Man's, you know, the uncle who was sort of a father figure to him being killed and how that shapes his story, this storylines, it doesn't rely on that mythology for its meaning. It turns things in really new ways. And I think pop culture savvy viewers are going to enjoy all the little references along the way. There's a poster on Miles Morales' wall of Chance the Rapper and Chance's face smiling down on him. It's sort of, it's almost like a little guardian angel in the movie. And if you know who Chance the Rapper is and you know what he represents, then that becomes a really wonderful accent, so to speak, on in the movie.
Well, before I let you go, we probably should wrap this up here. We've gone a while. I want to ask you about a couple movies that you didn't mention that I've had some conversations about people with, and that a couple people have asked me about. There's three in particular that I'm curious. I think it's three that you haven't mentioned that I'm curious about. One is A Quiet Place, which came out much earlier in the year. John Krasinski, a horror film with Emily Blunt, his wife. She stars in it. And I'm curious, what's your take on that one?
You know, I've been baffled this year because my students, my undergraduate students, are they don't go to the movies very often. They go see Marvel movies. You know, they were really into Harry Potter, but now they mostly binge watch things on YouTube or Netflix. They're more into television. They're more into series. They rarely go to the movies. I don't know what it was, but for some reason, a lot of them got up and went to the movies on opening weekend for A Quiet Place. I don't know if they're all big John Krasinski fans. I don't know if they're, I mean, there's a horror movie every week, it seems like, and they don't go see all of those. So I'm kind of stumped as to why that film connected with them so much. I admired it. It's got a great performance by Emily Blunt. She might even get a nomination for that. It has a rare portrait. Right. Yeah, she's had a big year. Well, and so has John Krasinski, who plays her husband in this, who is her husband in real life, and who directed the movie. he's having a big year too, playing Jack Ryan on Amazon. Of course, the big draw in this movie is the fact that you have to be quiet or the monsters will come. And so the movie uses silence really, really effectively. And so in that sense, I can see how word of mouth made this movie a big deal, because you can only really have that experience in a theater. You can only really appreciate that when you realize you are in a room with hundreds of other people and you are all holding your breath so that you can hear a pin drop, because if a pin drops, it could change the whole story. So as far as that goes, it has a great gimmick and it uses it very, very effectively. And it's a very family focused story. As horror movies go, it's surprisingly low on gore. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the scares really work. I can't say it was an important one for me because I've seen a lot of horror movies that use silence very effectively, but they aren't necessarily movies that a lot of audiences have seen, and they certainly aren't movies that young people are familiar with. Yeah. So it's a well-crafted genre piece, but I don't. I mean, I'm sure the problem is me, but I'm not getting why it's such a big deal.
Yeah.
There will be a sequel though, so we'll see if it holds up as a franchise.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. I heard an interview with John Krasinski and he was saying that it's not really about the same people so much as it is the same world, which is an interesting, maybe less common concept for properties that make as much money as A Quiet Place did. So it'd be interesting to see if he's committed to that or if they kind of slip into old habits, so to speak. I mean, not that the old habits didn't work, but it'll certainly keep the sequel from being as inventive as it could be if they just returned to the well.
You know, if I were to keep digging about what's meaningful about this movie, it may be that by embracing that gimmick, they require their main characters to pay closer attention to each other than they would in any other circumstance. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, these characters have intimate relationships in a way that we're not used to seeing. And maybe this speaks to, sort of like we were saying about some of these other movies, maybe this speaks to our deepening sense that we are losing a vital sense of intimacy in human relationships. And these parents and children have to give each other their full attention because their lives depend on it. Maybe that's what's going on. I don't know.
Well, another movie that uses silence, or well, sometimes a lack thereof, sort of uniquely, is Damien Chazelle's First Man, the Ryan Gosling movie. That was one that I think maybe it didn't live up to some of the hype and kind of faded away more quickly than people expected it to, although we'll see what happens when Academy Award nominations come out, both for Ryan Gosling and Damien Chazelle. But did you see First Man, and what did you think of that one?
Yeah, I did see it. I admired it very much. Damien Chazelle's movies, I think the best way I know to appreciate this film is to see it as a Damien Chazelle movie. And Damien Chazelle has made movies about people who, in their ambitions, end up compromising human relationships, especially family, to a damaging degree. So Whiplash is about a young man who wants to be a great drummer and makes kind of a Faustian bargain with a demanding drum teacher, music teacher, who really seduces him to pursue excellence to the degree that he damages his relationships with his family. In La La Land, as inspiring and playful and upbeat as that movie is, at its heart, it's a story about how the call to stardom ends up costing true love in a way. And some people will argue and say, well, in this case, it was justified. I mean, if they settled for each other, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just thinking, you had true love there. And now you're going to live always wondering, you know, what if I'd stuck with it? In First Man, it's the story of Neil Armstrong. And so there's a lot of speculation and fictionalizing going on as we try to understand what motivates him to get to the moon. Is it that he's profoundly moved by a sense of wonder, as he says in the movie when he's put on the spot? Or is it that his colleagues are dying right and left because of NASA's failed experiments, and he wants to make those deaths mean something by getting there and finishing the job himself? Or is it about losing his daughter? Early in the film, we see Neil Armstrong and his wife lose a child, and he seems profoundly wounded by that loss, and perhaps driven to overcome the laws of physics in a way, or to get beyond the human sphere. Why? To reconnect with her in some way, to honor her in some way. The movie leaves a lot of these questions sort of hanging, and I'm not sure it all works for me, but it was a very affecting experience. And by the end, what I was most interested in was what has happened now to this family as he has made it to the moon. I mean, spoiler, he makes it to the moon. What does that do to these boys who have practically lost their father, to his faithful and loving wife who has had to make unreasonable sacrifices and challenges for him to complete this mission? And I think the final image of the film is a big question about that, about, so what now? What has this been worth? Has this been worth it? Has the marriage been lost, or are they alienated from each other, or are they going to find their way back? I'm interested in discussing that with anybody who's seen the movie, because I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, it's definitely worth seeing. Ryan Gosling is very good. Claire Foy is even better. And the recreations of the moon landing mission are disorienting, to say the least, where a lot of them are very, I was talking with somebody about this earlier this morning, where a lot of space movies are about the grace of spaceships moving through space to classical music. This is about that feeling that you're inside, inside a washing machine out of control, being blasted out beyond the reach of gravity. And it was hard to watch in that sense.
One more that I want to ask you about that is also about marriage, actually, and it is a much smaller movie, and that's Paul Dano's Wildlife, which is based on a Richard Ford novel. It stars Carey Mulligan and Jake Gyllenhaal. Have you seen that one?
Not yet. That's on my list of the ones that got away right now. I do need to catch up with that. But as a Carey Mulligan fan, I'm definitely going to check that out. But I've read some very promising things about that one. What did you think?
Well, I haven't seen it. That's one, of the ones that that's the classic example of a movie that I'm probably going to have to wait to see, because it's probably never going to come near me or I'm going to have to drive. But I am a huge Carey Mulligan fan. I'll see movies that are otherwise very mediocre just because Carey Mulligan's in them. So, I would see it no matter what, but I like Richard Ford, so I'm curious to see how they approach his work. And, you know, that's quite a cast. Jake Gyllenhaal's in there, and the two of them together should be pretty electric on the screen in ways that
we've gotten this far without even mentioning Isle of Dogs, which was one of the most creative works of animation and handmade art that I've seen in a long time. We haven't talked about
the Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah. We haven't talked about The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, the new Coen Brothers movie, which we could spend a whole show talking about that.
Yeah. I was going to propose that, actually, because that's, I guess that could, I would love to, I actually really do want to discuss that, because I want to discuss whether some of those would be better suited would have been better suited as a series, and if some of them should have been expanded to be longer, and which ones work and which ones don't. I think they work to varying degrees. So that we could spend an hour just on that movie.
Yeah. I think it's a great Coen Brothers movie. I agree with a lot of the critics who have said that perhaps it's the best way to introduce people to the Coens' work, because each of those short stories sort of represents a different tone or a different style that they have done full movies in before. It really is a collection of very different short stories done in very different styles. It's strange in how it embraces traditional Western storytelling. Any one of these stories could have come from an anthology of early Western stories, but each one has that unique Coen Brothers twist where they're making you question things that we used to embrace. the most valuable thing to come out of that movie for me has been a debate I've been sort of witnessing and just listening to about the portrayal of Native Americans in the movie. Mm-hmm. They're not in it very much at all, but when they are, it's the kind of role that Native Americans have played in Western storytelling that was very demeaning and narrow and stereotyping. And the Coens don't really do much to challenge that in this. And it's got a lot of people pretty worked up and upset. And I'm sympathetic to those arguments. At the same time, I don't think they set out to make a movie to challenge us about about cultural stereotypes of Native Americans. I think they set out to make a movie that challenges us to think about the sort of manifest destiny attitude of Western storytelling. So it ends up challenging the sort of toxic masculinity at the heart of a lot of Western iconography.
And I think in that way, the most important or the most thematically, the short film in it that drives the story thematically is the one with Tom Waits, where he's the gold miner. I can't remember off the top of my head what it's called now, but Prospector. Yeah. I think that one is one of the most beautiful things they've ever done. I mean, it's incredibly well shot, but Tom Waits' performance is spot on. It's a great reminder that Tom Waits is actually a great actor. And I think that's the one that gets it, gets the most at a critique of that manifest destiny thing, that idea of going west. You know, a lot of times when you hear, that's an interesting one to compare to the Sisters Brothers, actually.
Very similar themes. Yeah.
They're going after something that's going to, you know, make them something better than what they currently are. It's like that by going west, there's some Garden of Eden out there, some promised land that's got something for you that's going to transform you magically into something better, more successful, that's going to change your life. But that oftentimes the promise of that leads you to being a very old man who wanders around the mountains by yourself, pursued by people who want to take everything you have. That's way more common than someone becoming very successful and, you know, becoming the big bad in Deadwood.
It'd be easy to spoil this one, so I won't, but if you watch that particular short, listen to the line that gets repeated over and over and over again in the dialogue before it's over, and then think about that line and what it says about the character who's saying it. It's a movie that could very narrowly be interpreted as a movie about a gold miner who is victorious, but instead I think it's a movie that profoundly questions both of its human characters and look at the way the natural world responds to human engagement in that short story. And I think that's where the real story is. Mm.
That one, for whatever reason, I mean, I guess it's because it has Tom Waits, but even the way that it was told reminded me of Down by Law for some reason. And I haven't been able to put my fingers on why exactly. I mean, I often see some similarities between Jarmusch and the Coen brothers. But I was watching that particular short, I know the Tom Waits part of it probably plays into this, but there was something else in there that I kept reminding me of Down by Law. I love Down by Law, so I think about it all the time. So that's probably maybe not a fair comment to make, but there was something about it. And I haven't been able to identify what that is yet. So that's something.
Well, Tom Waits is very good at playing characters that talk to themselves. True. And that sort of live half in their heads. And his character in Down by Law is a DA without a show. And so he's constantly narrating some kind of radio program that he's not really doing. And here he's narrating his experience. He's talking to the mountain. He's challenging the ground to give up its gold. I can see some correlation there.
Well, as you said, you never know what an individual person is going to take away from an experience with a movie. And that's why these conversations and these lists are so fun to discuss. Thank you so much for bringing your list. And I love that you said that, that one of the things you look out for is the movies that surprise you. And then in the end, your top two were Paddington 2 and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which you kept, I think the word you used them several times in discussing both those movies was how surprised you were at various elements of it. So comes full circle as far as that goes.
And I haven't even mentioned the movie that meant the most to my students this year, and that was Black Panther. So, I mean, there's still, we've just scratched the surface here, but I hope that some of these lesser known films will lead people to some meaningful discoveries. They've certainly become meaningful to me.
Hmm. Well, that's the beautiful thing about a great year in movies and about movies in general is we can spend almost 2 hours talking about something and barely scratch the surface. So, thank you for taking some time this afternoon to talk about these movies with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for setting aside substantial time to talk about them, because a lot of similar programs will last about 15 minutes and won't really get to the good stuff. So I feel like we could keep going if we wanted to. Thank you.
Well, that was Jeffrey Overstreet. Thanks to Jeffrey for joining me. I really enjoyed that. If you're still with us, thank you for listening. We really enjoyed doing a deep dive and getting a chance to talk about so many different movies. I hope that there were some things that you're interested in checking out. If you would like to find more of Jeffrey's reviews and more of his recommendations, remember you can head over to lookingcloser.org. And if you are a tweeter, you can find him over at Overstweet. So OverStweet, Overstweet. So thanks to Jeff for joining me, and thanks to everyone who listened this week. The early response on the podcast has been great, and I thank you for that. I thank you for your reviews and your comments and the kind words that everyone has been offering to me. It's great to be here with you, to be chatting with you about books, or on occasion, cheat and talk about movies. But this is going to be fun. I'm really excited. Next week, we're going to have an episode talking about why one very particular book was recently nominated or voted in a poll as the most popular book in America. So we're going to talk about that next week. And then after that, we've got an episode with some working writers about their process that I'm really excited about. So lots of great content coming up. Make sure you've subscribed. Make sure that you have left starred reviews if you're up for it, or a written review is even better. So thank you for participating and being a part of this show. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to everybody. 2019, looks like it's going to be a great year here on the Close Reads Podcast Network, and we are so excited for all the great content we're bringing you. I hope you are as well. Remember, you can follow us on Instagram at Close Reads Podcasts and on Twitter at Close Reads Pod. And with that, we'll talk to you in 2019. Thank you for listening.